Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, and welcome to Building Sustainability Podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey Hart, aka Jeffrey the Natural Builder. Building Sustainability consists of conversations with designers, builders, makers, dreamers, and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. Hello, and welcome to episode 44. This episode features Canadian author, educator, researcher, speaker and builder Chris Magwood. You may well be able to hear the wind and the rain here on the boat. The noise of creaking ropes has been pretty prominent in this last week in the UK. I'm trying to absorb and appreciate everything about boat life as I enter my last month of boat living. Plans for the tiny house are going really well. I've spent the last few evenings working out the weight of every available insulation versus its U value to find this sort of perfect ratio, because the trailer that I'm building my house on, I can only put on 2.9 tons, which sounds like a lot, but it's soon adding up. And it's quite frightening when you calculate exactly how much all of the things that you're going to put in a building are going to weigh. So it's really interesting, and it's bringing up some key decisions, like UK wood shingles weigh twice as much as metal sheet roofing. But the metal manufacturing process creates so many more carbon emissions. So I'm trying to find this balance point of what works. And it's really fun. It's fascinating to dig really deep into all the materials. Okay, so before I introduce Chris, I just wanted to say a huge, huge thank you to the Patreon subscribers. I honestly can't tell you how much your support means to me. Give yourself a massive high five and know that I think you're a really incredible human being. For anyone that enjoys the podcast and wants to contribute to its running costs and maybe even pay me a little bit, then head to patreon.com/buildingsustainability. You can name your own price or go for the £5 level, which gets you a hand-carved wooden spoon for eating your dinner with. Plus, there is bonus audio from the previous episodes for all subscribers. Okay, so, Chris Magwood. I was introduced to Chris Magwood by Emily Niehaus of Community Rebuilds. And she said, "This is Chris Magwood, and he's a superhero of building." And how right she was. I'm not really sure how he manages to fit it all in, but he's built upwards of 50 straw bale houses, taught hundreds, if not thousands, of people to do the same. He's written some of the best natural building books and somehow managed to find time to go back into education and complete a master's degree in building science. And you know what? To top it off, he's a thoroughly lovely chap too, as you're about to hear. So I'm back at the end, but quick reminder that if this is your first time here listening, make sure you subscribe to catch all of the future episodes and head back and listen to all the previous ones. Links are on the webpage. Enjoy the episode.
Well, I started as a owner builder in 1996, and then people very much started coming out of the woodwork when they heard about the house and say wanting to see it, wanting to talk about it, wanting to hear what I'd learned, and then started getting asked to help other people. And within a couple of years, my partners Pete and Tina and I, who had all kind of dabbled in straw bale right around the same time, formed a company, and we built straw bale houses for the next 10 years.
And so how did Endeavor Center come about?
Well, with our building company, we within the first couple of years started taking on one or two apprentices every year who would sort of spend a season with us and learn lots and then go on and kind of start their own company. We realized that we were already really early on in our business turning down work because more people wanted these kinds of buildings than we could deliver. And so we started taking on these apprentices. And after the first year, we were getting, you know, between 50 and 100 applications for this apprenticeship program that was never formally advertised, didn't really pay very well. And like people just heard about it and wanted to do it. And so that's when I realized like that there was, you know, it was great to be building, but teaching people how to do it was, you know, I was enjoying that part on site with the apprentices and realized that one or two people a year wasn't going to scratch the surface of the number of people who wanted to learn. So I sort of parted ways with the construction company and started teaching full time.
Yeah. Nice. And you've built a lot.
Yes.
Your portfolio. Have you got, what's your sort of estimate on how many
between the straw bale company and Endeavor? It's upwards of 50 now. I have never done an accurate count, but
so yes, you're definitely a man of experience.
Yeah, and I don't think we've ever built anything the same way twice. So, you know, it's every time out, it's been a new learning experience and, you know, sort of an iterative process of just trying to make it better every time. So I feel like that's still happening. We're still not at the point where it's like, okay, here's the perfect way to do this. So, yeah, always keen to just keep trying new things.
Well, perfect is an illusion, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
excellent. So I've sort of loosely given this this podcast a working title of "How Buildings Are Going to Save the World," which I think is what we're both excited about. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'd quite like to start with is hearing you talk about what maybe sort of the issues with the current built environment and the way we're approaching things and sort of materials and things like that.
Yeah, I think that has sort of morphed for me a little bit over, you know, the 25 years I've been doing this. It very much for me started as a resource issue and an energy efficiency issue. So when I built my first house, when I started looking at housing, I realized how sort of appallingly poorly insulated our buildings were, especially like we're in a very cold climate, and our code at that time was pretty low on requirements for kind of thermal performance. And then just sort of like looking at the range of materials that people were using and realizing that, you know, almost everything that went into a house was coming from some sort of threatened resource in some way or another, whether it was, you know, metals or timbers or, you know, petrochemicals, you know, it, like all of these things were sort of finite materials that, so that was those were the first things that I was trying to kind of save the world by doing. And then I quickly started learning lots about the kind of chemical content and the health issues with those materials. One of our really early projects at Camelsback Construction was for three women who are building themselves a co-housing building. And the reason they had banded together was because they all had extreme chemical sensitivities. And so they came to us because they had thought that a straw bale house would be a clean building for them. But then they also wanted us to look at everything else that they were going to put in the house, because they couldn't get anybody else to do that research for them or take it seriously. You know, they were just kind of getting shrugged off or laughed off by other builders. And when they gave me the list of chemicals that they needed excluded from the building, and I started really researching all the things that even we, as what I felt was quite conscious builders at the time, were putting in, it was horrifying to see, you know, just the sort of insanity of how laden with quite dangerous chemicals our buildings were then and still are now. So that kind of added a piece to, you know, to the Save the World agenda. And then over the last decade, the climate impact of the buildings and the materials has also, you know, taken a real central stage for me. So, you know, we're now trying to put, like, how do you build all of those things together so that you're not sacrificing any one of those criteria for the other? Because that's what I see happens a lot in the building world. You know, people did get excited about high performance over the last couple decades, but they went down the high performance level and never thought about resources, never thought about, you know, chemical content, didn't think about owner health, and didn't think about the climate. So they made really energy efficient buildings. And then over on this side, you had people really attuned to the chemical content, but building inefficient buildings. And, you know, like, it's just, you know, how do you bring all of that together so that it's, you're not just pursuing one narrow vision, but you're building so that you're addressing all of those. And I don't know if building that way saves the world, but it certainly stops it from spiraling in quite the same speed it's spiraling right now. So
yeah. I lived in BC for 5 winters, and the range of houses I lived in were, you know, from little old shacks to fairly new build, but never did I think they were as insulated as they should have been for, you know, what was pretty much 6 months of snow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you sat in Canada's greenest home right now? Is that your house?
I am. Yeah.
Nice. I wondered if that was your house. Mm-hmm. I was intrigued by your use of the word green in the sort of promotion of that house. Mm-hmm. Certainly over here, green has sort of become one of those words which has been sort of taken over by sort of all the companies wanting to appear like they're making a difference but actually doing nothing. And I wondered if that was a deliberate choice of wording to sort of appeal to a bigger market.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we sort of attached that nickname. This project happened in 2012. And so, yeah, it felt like at that time, it wouldn't have been like my word of choice necessarily. And I think I know I struggle and all of us at Endeavor struggle with what are the words to describe what we're doing. But yeah, we really did want this building to get some attention, not just from the sort of natural building niche world, but from, you know, the sort of larger construction industry and sort of wider slice of society. And so, you know, at that point, you know, green was kind of the word in the industry at that time. And so we just kind of wanted to put it out there and say, well, we're the greenest. And so come check it out. You know, and there, you know, there was no real, well, that's not true. We set up our own criteria to, you know, we didn't want to just do that thing of, well, we'll just make up this name and do this. You know, we set some criteria around all of those things I said, like, you know, it was like a passive house level, you know, of performance. It had zero chemical content inside the building. You know, like we actually set goals that we said, well, this is why we're calling this the greenest home, because if these are the things by which greenness is ranked, we haven't seen anything, you know, better than this. So My partner in Endeavor is highly uncomfortable with that that terminology. So, it was a debatable thing even within Endeavor, let alone outside. So.
I'm interested by this sort of looks of the house, because again, it feels like you've gone for that sort of conventional look. But I'm assuming very much, you know, under the surface, it's all the things that, you know, you've just spoken about.
Yeah. So our real intent was to sort of make the kind of like natural building sleeper house, you know, because I think a lot of people, when they hear about greenhouses, and especially if you attach the word sort of natural building to it, there's this instant association with, you know, the Cobb hut and the Hobbit house, which I actually, you know, I have no issue with that at all, but it's not what everybody is interested in. And there's, you know, what we wanted to do is show that all of those same materials and all of those same principles, you can put them together. And I mean, the house is, we're in the middle of a city on an urban lot. It's an infill house. So what we wanted to do is say, you can do all of that stuff, like all of that great stuff that comes out of the natural building world, and plunk it right in the middle of a city and fit in and not sacrifice any of those ideals in order to do that.
Yeah. There's definitely, to some people, that sort of, you know, curvy aesthetic is like the dream. And then to other people, it's, you know, just disgusting.
Yeah.
So it's just hitting them at what is sort of normal to them.
Yeah.
And I think what a focus of mine is sort of making homes which you don't even call them an eco home or, you know, a green home. Mm-hmm. You know, it just so happens that it's not going to kill you, and you know, it's going to keep you warm. So what is it that makes this home green?
Well, it is extremely energy efficient. This was the first place where we were able to use, it's mostly a straw bale house, and it's the first time we were able to kind of combine straw bale and clay plasters with a really high level of air tightness. So, you know, we actually hit the passive house level of air tightness with these natural materials. So, you know, it performs really well. There's no fossil fuel use in the building at all. It's electrified. We produce as much energy as we use in the house, PV panels and solar hot water. We've got a really great air exchange system, so the air quality is really high. Like I said, we vetted all the interior materials really carefully, so there's like absolutely no questionable chemical content inside the building. Those would be things. And we did it on a really reasonable budget. So it wasn't like, you know, it's just spending whatever it took to achieve that. It was, let's do this, you know, at a price that everybody can, you know, that sort of in the market range for our area.
Yeah. Would you say that, well, did you go for Living Building Challenge with this build?
Well, that's what we started with. The idea was we were going to get Living Building Challenge certified. So the design was done with all of those principles, you know, the material selection. We ran into a few issues with the Living Building Challenge standard as it was at the time. In particular, you know, we had made a decision that all the subflooring in the building would be tongue and groove pine rather than plywood or anything with, because we couldn't, at that time, we couldn't get a plywood that didn't have formaldehyde glues, and sort of built right into the Living Building Challenge is no formaldehyde, but then they make an exception for plywood because at that time you couldn't get it without. And so we made this decision to go to a local lumber yard or local lumber mill and get this 1x8 pine for the flooring, but they weren't FSC certified. And so, you know, we kind of chose actually not having formaldehyde over having an FSC certification on the floor. So there were a few material things like that where it's like we felt like we actually made the choice that we were more comfortable with, but it didn't meet their criteria at the time. Okay. And also I really like the Living Building Challenge's take on sort of water and being water independent. I think for very good reason, the city here doesn't want like septic systems in the city, which is basically how you would get a Living Building Challenge thing done. And that's another place where I sort of disagreed with them. It's like, you know, we had a composting toilet system, so we wouldn't have been sending black water to the city's waste system, but our gray water would have been going to, well, it does go to the city, but I sort of feel like, well, I'm using, you know, Living Building Challenge is fine with me using the electrical grid to, you know, it's a public facility that where I can put my power on and take my power off, but there's this other public infrastructure that could take my gray water and is already set up to treat it. And I don't think it makes any sense for every single house in the city to have a giant concrete tank and a weeping field and plastic pipes. Like, so, you know, between all the places where we kind of disagreed, you know, there wasn't much of a certification left, but it was an amazing, amazing, like, guideline to work with. You know, I would say with the exception of the wastewater and the plywood and a few other things, you know, we didn't really diverge at all, but those were large enough issues that the certification wasn't possible.
But I mean, I guess you've taken the sort of principles and the intention of it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I saw you talk at the Strawbell conference in Colorado, and you were saying that it was like a one person's full-time job to be researching and mm-hmm. pulling in all the information for it. So,
yeah.
You know, the sort of learning from that must have been immense.
It was, it was really helpful. And it mapped really closely to what we already kind of do at Endeavor. I mean, but it was great to see it that well laid out. You know, we had kind of been doing those exact same things with not just a notion that we were doing the right thing, but not as well structured a way to ensure that we were doing those things. So mm-hmm. it made for a really great map that way.
Nice. And is the Living Building Challenge something you've sort of continued with your work, or is it?
No, we've never tried to certify again. Because I think, you know, I feel like we would run into a lot of the same issues where they make exceptions, we don't make exceptions, and where we make exceptions, they don't make exceptions. So, you know, but I feel like, you know, we with our full-time course, you know, we really teach the Living Building Challenge. We look at the project we're doing with our class that year through that lens, and we, you know, the discussions in the class end up being about why we vary or where we vary, but we're still very much, you know, using that kind of roadmap to show people who come and take a course what we're doing and why.
Uh-huh. Sorry, I know this is quite an old project for you, but we're talking about it quite a lot, but we'll get on to some newer stuff. I mean, I guess what would be interesting to me is to know what sort of lessons have been learned just by living in the house? And you've had quite a few years of data now.
So. Yeah, it's been really interesting. Like, there haven't been any issues. It's been really surprising. Right. Or actually, the issues that there have been, it's not that there haven't been any, had nothing to do with the sort of, you know, green or sustainable natural side of things. All the shower controllers gave out at one time or another. You know, there have been things like that. But in terms of any of the sort of green components of the house, you know, there haven't been any issues. The heating, the ventilation, the solar, like all of that stuff has, oh no, actually that's not true. Squirrels ate all the wires off the back of our solar panels.
Okay, yeah.
And now the code actually the code to install solar on a roof in Ontario is now you have to close it in with a screen, because it wasn't just us. It happens all the time. So that came up. But, you know, again, that's not sort of special to this house and the way we built it. But
sure. I was interested to know, because it's a SIP panel, isn't it? Construction.
Yeah. So we built like prefabricated straw bale wall panels to build mm-hmm. most of the house.
And what was your thinking? What was your sort of reasoning for that over a bale infill or something similar?
Well, there were some practical concerns. We are an urban infill, and we're a full two-story house. So the notion of trying to stack bales, you know, on site with not enough room to put scaffolding between our house and the next house, you know, there were just some really practical concerns. But also we had built panels with our class for some earlier projects, and just felt like if there was really going to be a way to make straw bale building in particular accessible to a wider market, that it was going to be in that form where you don't have to source the straw, you don't have to learn how to plaster, you don't have to train a whole crew on a whole new way of building. Just these squares arrive, they get plunked down in place, you bolt them to the floor, and you move on. That just seemed like, you know, a much more likely scenario for something like straw bale building to hit a wider audience.
Yeah, definitely. It seems to be the way that a lot of people are taking it, certainly mm-hmm. sort of ModCell and EcoCocon and I mean, it's something I haven't yet done, but it seems to me like the push that the industry sort of needs.
And we've lately been making our panels without any plaster, but when we're making these plastered ones, you know, it also, here in Ontario, plastering is not a profession. Like, nobody knows how to do it. It's never been a common trade here. And so that was a huge barrier to straw bale construction in Ontario. Was our company was literally the only company. If you didn't want to plaster it yourself, we were your option, and we could only do, you know, a certain number of houses in a year. And so with the panels, you know, all the plastering is done with the panel lying flat, and there's literally no skill to it. It's like pouring a sidewalk. You pour the plaster on, you screed it across the panel, and you've got this one coat, really flat, you know, plaster system done in minutes instead of hours or days. So it really kind of like spoke to that side too of making it more accessible.
Yeah, definitely. And so what happens at the joins in a pre-plastered system?
Well, we've actually treated it a whole bunch of different ways. At this house, what we actually did was just drywall right over all those joints. Again, that was sort of a nod to how do you make this system accessible to a sort of more mainstream contractor? Don't ask them to deal with plaster joints. You know, they all have drywallers or do the drywall themselves. And so you give them a really nice flat surface. They come in, they put their board on, and they kind of treat it like that. So we have two ends of the house where we did use the plaster because I wanted to see it, but mm-hmm. In general, a lot of it was just drywalled.
And then externally, what have you got there?
It's sided with a combination of like horizontal wood and cedar shingles.
Mm-hmm. With some sort of membrane behind, or?
Yeah, with like a sort of air barrier membrane. Yeah, and there's a plaster on the straw on the outside too. So it's, you know, the straw is all covered that way. And then we kind of strapped on top of that and made a rain screen scenario for the siding.
Nice. Yeah. While we're talking about that, I guess a question that comes up a lot for me, and I just saw a raging argument in the Natural Homes Facebook page about EcoCocon, actually, because they were you know, sort of promoting their panels with
I think they use a wood fiber board, right? They do like a wood fiber board,
yes,
cladding, well, on the outside.
The issue was there was a sort of plastic membrane offered as an optional right. thing, and so there was the argument between the, you know, the pure naturals and plastic. Yeah,
right.
So I was wondering where you sit on that.
You know, we try to build with as little plastic as possible, but I'm not such a purist that, you know, if I see that very thin membrane layer, and I'm sure EcoCocoon is smart enough that it's a smart permeable layer as well, is somebody would have to also tell me that they've decided not to have plumbing, not to have a refrigerator. Like, okay, if you're going full life plastic free, then you can argue the plastic membrane. But if your house has any other plastics and this is a real solution that is, you know, provides meaningful performance to that building and makes a straw bale building possible for some people, I would go with the plastic membrane. You know, it's not, you know, my fridge probably has more plastic in it than the membrane that goes around the outside of my house. My PEX plumbing definitely does. You know, it's the plastic coating on all my electrical wiring. I mean, if I'm going to be a purist, mm-hmm. I shouldn't have those things. And if I'm going to have those things, then to me, that's more of a choice. You know, you could choose a way to do the building that doesn't have it, but I wouldn't say, well, you shouldn't do it because it has fraction of a millimeter's worth of a plastic coating on it.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
That's good to hear. So I've been wrestling with it because pretty much all the buildings I've ever built have been hemp or straw or something that gets a render and a plaster to be an airtightness layer. But this tiny house I'm building, because it's going to be moving around, I don't really want to rely on plaster for that because mm-hmm. I think the movement's prone to cracking.
Yeah.
So for the first time, I'm looking at an airtightness, barrier membrane and feeling a little bit icky about it. But also, if we're looking at performance, then...
And this might be a sort of a segue into the carbon footprint things, but if, I guess, the question would be, what is somebody's reason for not wanting that plastic layer? And there's a performance side where if that's really just a sheet of impermeable poly and it's on the outside of your wall, you're probably going to actually cause damage to the wall. So it's like, okay, like you got to be smart about what that layer is. But if that layer is going to make my building airtight, and airtightness makes such a huge difference to the energy performance of a building. Like people get obsessed with insulation and it's like, you can insulate 5 feet thick if you want, but if your building's not airtight, that 5 feet of insulation doesn't do, like it works to a certain point, but the air leakage just takes over and becomes, that's where you're losing your heat. And so, if that plastic membrane is well applied and ups the level of performance of the building and saves, either on the need for more insulation or on fuel and energy to heat and cool the building for the rest of its lifespan, you pretty much guarantee that it's worth the investment of that amount of resource and carbon pollution to achieve the results on the other side.
I saw a talk from Craig White from Mudcell and Agile Homes and all the other things he's involved in. But he talks, as well as sort of carbon sequestering, he talks about plastic sequestering and keeping plastic out of the environment, which I think to me felt like it was pushing it a little bit. but I thought it was quite a nice, made a nice graph at least.
Yeah.
Great. So, I mean, we've sort of, we're heading onto it there, but talking about, buildings saving the world, some buildings are going to be very sort of carbon intensive, both in use and to build. Like what do you see as kind of the way forward in that?
Well, I mean, without being too flippant, everybody needs to build with straw bale.
Okay.
Or more generally, you know, if we can start to think about our buildings as places to meaningfully store carbon that was in the atmosphere very recently, and we can get it into our buildings for a long period of time, that is an incredible contribution to the climate issue. Mm-hmm. Globally, if we did that well, it's at a gigaton per year scale, given how much we're building, like possibly multiple gigatons a year. And it sort of has a double benefit of, you know, a lot of that ag residue either gets burned off, in which case the carbon goes back to the atmosphere immediately, or it's kind of rotted off, in which case it goes back to the atmosphere immediately, and some of it as methane, which is a more potent greenhouse gas. So you kind of stop that from happening, and you put it in buildings where it's not going to end up back in the atmosphere for, if we do it smartly, a few centuries. And if we haven't got our climate act together within the lifespan of a decently built building, you know, I get asked that a lot. It's like, oh, what happens at the end of the lifespan of all these buildings? It's like, well, let's get there. Like, if we're putting a lot of carbon away in buildings and we actually like are all doing okay and surviving in 100 years, when the carbon starts to come out of these buildings, we will have figured out how to take the carbon out of the buildings in a decent way. I mean, already you can say, well, turn it into biochar. You can, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm really excited about panelized systems is, you know, if we make not just a panel that's easy to install, but a panel that's easy to uninstall, then the carbon I've stored in that panel outlives the building it was in. You know, when this building is done, most of our buildings we tear down, not because they failed, but because we just don't want that building in that place anymore. So make carbon storing buildings that you can dismantle and reassemble somewhere else, or that the parts can be used in other places. Now we've got 200, 300 years of storage. You know, that feels adequate for addressing the climate. But yeah, I mean, I did, you know, just a really quick bit of research where I looked at how much grain straw is grown annually. So, you know, UN statistics on wheat, oats, barley, you know, rye, like the typical grain straws. And the straw portion, the part that we don't eat, is over 2 billion tons a year. So just those crops have brought all the carbon emissions of the country of India out of the atmosphere this year, put it into tubular straw form that makes a great building material, and we just don't do anything with it. We just burn it up and put it back into the atmosphere. And it's like, we could literally be drawing down India's emissions annually just with plants that we've already planted. And that's just straw. That's not coconut or rice or hemp or like palm kernels, or like, it's, you know, there are literally like, you know, billions and billions of tons of ag residues that would make great and do make great building materials. People already make stuff out of these things, that if our building industry moved in that direction, you know, it would go from being one of the worst offenders in what happens to the climate to literally like reversing climate change with buildings and
saving the world.
I get really excited about that notion. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, because that has been irking me a lot. So I did, Sukita came on the podcast and we talked about earth floors, and one of the Facebook comments when I posted it was someone saying, because I'd said, you know, they're the most sustainable floors, kind of flippantly as like a, you know, as a promotional tool. But someone replied, well, I'd rather use a wood floor because it's sequestering carbon. And I got into a big muddle because of that, what happens at the end of the life if it's, you know, if it's going to be rotted or you know, burnt or disposed of, that wooden floor.
Yeah. It's wood is tricky because, you know, whereas I think, or I'm very confident that we can attribute meaningful storage to sort of annual agricultural residues, wood isn't necessarily the same thing because if you just left the forest alone, there's a good chance that more carbon would get stored by not cutting down the tree than by cutting down the tree and putting it in a building. Mm-hmm. So whereas at the end of that, the farm season, the growing season, that straw is getting cut down. Like it has no more growth to offer and it's going to get replanted next year. And so like that's real carbon storage. Carbon comes out of the atmosphere 1 year, goes in a building, comes out of the atmosphere the next year, goes in a building. But with timber, it's much harder to say that that's the case because a kilogram of carbon atoms in my wood floor, that sure, there's carbon in my wood floor, but how much of the tree didn't make it into my floor? You know, it's typically about half a tree doesn't make it into the product. And so all of that carbon went back into the atmosphere. So already at best, I'm carbon neutral in my floor. And if carbon came out of the forest floor when that happened, like when the harvesting happened, that's an emission that counts against my floor. And if the stalks of the forest, the actual carbon stock of our forests globally are getting smaller, the fact that we're sticking that dead carbon in our buildings, but our live carbon stocks are getting smaller, it doesn't necessarily balance out. I think we could probably manage our forests in a way that would allow us to say the wood floor is storing carbon, but I don't treat a wood floor the same way I treat a straw wall or a hemp wall or, you know, any other fiber that is on a short cycle and is basically a residue of an existing process.
Uh-huh. So presumably you're not counting like a coppice product in that sort of timber.
No, I guess a coppice thing would be different. You'd have to look at it differently. I think generally when we look at timber, very little of it is a coppice product. It's mostly, you know, actual cutting down of trees. But yeah, I think you would look at that differently. And bamboo kind of fits somewhere in between those things and cork, where, you know, it's a 6 to 10 year growing cycle, which is a lot shorter than a timber cycle. And the period of like the speed of regrowth is a lot faster. Also, you know, with bamboo, it's a rhizome, so you don't disturb the soil carbon in the same way when you cut it down. But it, you know, the longer the longer the regrowth period, there's sort of like a, not a penalty, but you'd sort of discount the carbon storage slightly based on how long it takes something to regrow. So it's like the annual ag products that kind of have the highest return on sort of putting them away as carbon storage.
And then what's interesting to me is that while I love building with straw, I'm also quite conscious that it's a monocropped product. It's quite, it's part of our, a really unsustainable food growing method. How do you how do you balance that?
Well, I sort of feel like, you know, there's kind of two parallel pressures going on right now with, so, you know, I'm sort of looking at it from the building side and me deciding to either build or not build with straw, or even 10,000 of me doing that doesn't change industrial agriculture. But as the pressure builds on people to work with materials like straw, there's also pressure building up for the agriculture industry to get better at managing soil carbon and things like that. So, you know, there is a lot more going on now with like no-till farming and, you know, people planting, you know, underlayer crops and things like that, where I feel like if we're all taking climate seriously, I'm not a farmer and I'm not in the ag business, so I'm not going to address their problem. But I feel like if I'm addressing the building side by, you know, paying farmers for this stuff, that helps support an agriculture industry that's also capable of changing. Like if I can change the building industry, they can change the agriculture industry, but I can't feel responsible for both.
Yes.
But if I can support the farmers, you know, and I right now with my straw choices, I can make that choice. I can support an organic farmer and buy their straw. I can support, you know, somebody whose practices I can go and see and understand and know about. So I think, you know, yeah, the source of those things and the where they're available and how much they're available are likely to change. But given that we all are still going to be eating in the future, and we're going to be growing plants to eat, and those plants are going to have an awful lot of leftover fiber, we're always going to be able to figure out a way to do it. And so if right now it's monocrop wheat straw, I will use that. And if in 10 years it's fabulous organic, you know, multi-story harvested, you know, carbon storing straw crop of some kind, I will use that. But it's, I think, you know, it's always going to be there unless we decide to stop eating.
Definitely. Have you heard there's a, over here there's some people growing miscanthus, which is a perennial grass which grows
really tall. Super tall.
And they've been baling that up and have tried a few buildings out with it. It's exciting the way that people are starting to look at, you know, things that grow and how they grow and how what the sort of beneficial
Yeah, I have some bales in the shop right now that are switchgrass bales, and the switchgrass is being grown as a rotational crop in order to build up the soil carbon for other crops. So it's like a, you know, somebody will put a field into 3 years of switchgrass rotation. That root structure builds up the soil carbon really well. I get 3 years of bales for my buildings. And then they return it back to wheat production, you know, after that rotation. So, like, I think however farming develops, you know, an ag-based building system can develop with it. And if I'm building with switchgrass bales or miscanthus bales or, you know, whatever it happens to be, there will always be a source of those things. I just noticed Gramatherm, which I think is a Swiss company, they're making an insulation bat literally out of grass, and they have contracts to cut highway ditches and airport runways. And that's what they're putting into the insulation. You know, so I think there's just all this fiber growing all over the place. And if we're clever, we can, you know, make really good use of it.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Don't get too attached to your one fiber, but to the idea of, you know, of using those things.
Yeah, that's great. And there's so many different opportunities to, if we just look around us, just having that.
Yeah, I had that happen with, we were having an issue for a few years. There stopped being a source of hemp herds for us here in Ontario. The farms that had been growing it and processing went under for various reasons that, you know, but I was taking the sunflowers out of my own garden at the end of the season. And I was like, I think if I chop this up, I will get the same thing as hemp herd. And I did. And like, you literally couldn't tell the difference between that and hemp herd. And, you know, in North America, we grow like 10 million acres of sunflowers every year. And the stalks just, again, get thrown out. And it's like,
yeah,
okay, so I won't make hempcrete, I'll make sunflowercrete. You know, it's like, where is that fiber? You know, where does it exist?
Yeah.
And if you look around, yeah, it's there somewhere, and we can figure out how to put it to some decent use.
And great in that example that it's a, you know, what would be a waste product, you know, to make a co-product is so much more well-rounded in terms of, you know, what we're getting.
Yeah.
Can we talk about embodied carbon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
sure. Yeah.
It feels like certainly in the UK, or certainly away from the sort of hippie building world that I started in sort of, you know, America, was really big on embodied carbon. And then I came back to the UK and was sort of much more immersed in the sort of more building science world. And it seems like that's only just now really being picked up and shouted about, is, you know, that we need to look out for our embodied carbon, or upfront carbon, as a, you know, some, it's sort of Lloyd Alter was saying we should be looking at that, calling it that.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, that's been my obsession for the last, I guess, probably 5 years. Which started with trying to calculate that sort of upfront carbon footprint of our own projects here at Endeavor, and both like early on, like in this house in 2012, when I tried to do it, I just couldn't find enough data to even take a stab at it. I then came across the inventory of carbon and energy database, which is from University of Bath, which was kind of like the first free publicly available kind of database of that. And I started using that on our buildings, even though, you know, there's probably some differences between how things are made in the UK and here, but, and it was really shocking. Like it really made me see buildings in a very different way, where suddenly when you see the sort of climate impact of the making of things like cement for concrete, like foam insulation, those things where suddenly like their proportion of the carbon footprint of a building is massive, and you know, getting away from those or minimizing the use of those, suddenly, you know, you can bring the carbon footprint of a building way down. And then kind of what I'm now fascinated with is what we've just been talking about. On the other side of that, there's this whole carbon storage side. So, you know, you can lower the actual carbon footprint, the actual emissions associated with making the materials. And then if you put in a bunch of materials that have meaningful carbon storage, you can kind of net your building out, or even make it a sort of net storer of carbon. So when you kind of do all the accounting, all the emissions minus all the storage, you can sometimes, and you know, this is what the natural building world has been doing so effectively for so long without realizing that, you know, we've been doing exactly what the climate needs us to do, which is minimize the polluters and maximize the carbon storers. And, you know, we have these buildings that are literally, I can make a building that the climate is in better shape at the end of my building than it was at the start. Like there's more atmospheric carbon in my building, and so therefore less in the atmosphere than before I started this project. And, you know, that's, to me, that's super exciting to kind of get away from the building industry sort of reductionism of like, oh, let's reduce our impact by 10% or 20%. It's like, no, how about let's just reverse it? Like, let's just not have an impact and actually do some good, rather than just like try to creep like slightly lower in our impacts.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a really great graph in your, Building as a Climate Change Solution thesis, from the Builders for Climate Change white paper, which shows the embodied or upfront carbon, you know, from day one. There it is. It's a set amount and it's going to stay there forever. Yeah. And it was, you were estimating about sort of 10 years until the sort of in-use carbon is actually catching up to that point.
Yeah, or never. Like, you know, if you... it can be sort of like 5 to 10 years if you're continuing to make a sort of less efficient building that's heated with fossil fuels. But if you actually are using renewable energy and your building's really efficient, you know, it will go on being a carbon storage vessel for a couple of centuries. So, and I think that's it got ignored for so long because we used to be so carbon intensive with our buildings. Like they were so poorly performing, and we use so much fossil fuel that it's, when people looked at the contribution of the materials, it was like, oh, that's tiny. But as we've squeezed the operating emissions down, now when you look at the sort of upfront emissions from the materials, it's like, oh, that's really big, you know. And in some cases, it's the biggest slice of the overall pie versus, you know, kind of being this little bit upfront.
I had to deal with quite a few people that were building their passive homes, you know, and I was asking them about their construction, and it's like, wow, it's a big concrete box, you know, and we've got thermal mass is important.
With foam. We've put
loads of concrete down, yeah, and we've wrapped it in foam. And I was like, oh, how are you missing the point so badly? But it was, you know, it just seemed like it was the way that everyone was building for a while.
Yeah. And it's been really interesting. Like, you know, I've been out sort of presenting at Passive House and sort of high performance conferences, and that message about the importance of the material emissions, some people have been very dismissive, but for a surprising number of people have been like, oh, I need to change what I'm doing then. Like, I thought there was going to be a lot more resistance and sort of pushback, but when I start presenting the data, like, because most of the people in the Passive House movement, they're in it for the right reasons, you know, like they have the climate and the planet in, you know, in their hearts, or they wouldn't be doing this crazy thing that they're doing. So when it sort of like gets demonstrated that, well, if you do it in this particular way, you're not actually having the effect you thought you were. Like you're causing these unintended consequences, and if we look at those, it what you're doing doesn't pan out. But it's not that Passive House doesn't pan out, because, you know, in our buildings and in my study, the best results were build a passive house with carbon storing materials. Like, it's then you've kind of got this win-win going on of way reduced operating emissions and, you know, either low embodied carbon or your carbon storing. Like, that's the winning scenario. So it's not like saying, oh, passive house is terrible, it's, we shouldn't be doing it. No, we should all be doing it. We should just be doing it and paying attention to the materials that go in.
Yeah.
Which kind of loops us around to where we started, like, and pay attention to what's the chemical loading of the materials we're putting in, and where did they come from, and what were the conditions for the people who put them in. Yeah. You know, like, you bring all these criteria together, and it's like, that's real, you know, whatever you want to call it, green building, sustainable building, natural building. It's like, it's where you look at the whole picture, you know, because you don't want to do one of these things that unintentionally causes all kinds of havoc in these other areas. So.
Yeah, I like that. You know, the sales pitch to someone who's sort of that more sort of concrete and foam idea that, you know, you could do all of this, and, you know, as an unintended consequence, you're going to live longer and healthier, and you're going to be surrounded by nice things. It's,
yeah,
it shouldn't be a hard sell.
No.
So in the white paper, the building as climate change solution, there was some case studies about different homes that you've built. And there was a big range in difference in how much carbon there was sequestered. So, you know, from ranging from 24 kilograms up to sort of 360. I mean, what was the what was the cause of the sort of big difference there?
It's sort of, you know, they all of those buildings had quite a bit of stored carbon in the form of straw or cellulose or hemp or, you know, whatever the materials happen to be. But some of them also had, you know, like this house here, we also have a basement in it. And so there's a concrete floor in the basement. We have a sort of insulated concrete form system that's a wood chip based system, but it still has concrete in it. You know, things like metal roofing, some of those buildings have like some portions of metal siding on the outside. So it's always, you know, it's sort of a balancing act of, you know, we're not just building with plants. Like there's always glass involved, and there's always some metal involved, and there's always, you know, not always concrete, but sometimes there's concrete involved. And so when you you know, add up those ledgers depending on how much of the emitting materials you've used. The storage that you're contributing is going to either show up as a larger number or a smaller number depending on what it's being used to offset. Yeah.
So really, I mean, you've got to be on it with looking at all of your materials and really, yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess that leads us really nicely to the BEAM, Building Emissions Accounting Materials. Did I say that right?
Yep. Accounting for materials. Yep.
Yes. So what's that about?
So yeah, that's out of all this research and work I've been doing on the carbon footprint. So yeah, you mentioned my thesis. I went back to school to kind of, you know, do this study on upfront emissions. And in doing that, I kind of amassed a pretty big data bank of, you know, the embodied carbon numbers for like 400 different residential building materials. And I realized, and then I built it into a spreadsheet to do these calculations for the thesis buildings. And then I started realizing, oh, like I have this spreadsheet with all of this stuff. If I rethought it, I could make it so that you could input any building and, you know, choose the materials you want to use and get an answer. And so that's kind of over the last year, we've decided to kind of turn that into a publicly available tool called BEAM, which should be launching in probably May. So we're getting close to that. So it's shifted from a spreadsheet to an online app. And, you know, we've built in lots of cool functions that my original clunky spreadsheet didn't have. But, you know, at heart, what I really like about it and what all of our beta testers have liked is that it starts by putting in the kind of overall dimensions of your building and some of the sort of building geometry. But then as you go to choose the materials for your building, you already see what the carbon footprint of all the options in that section. So if I'm looking at flooring or I'm looking at roofing or insulation, when I get to that part of the calculator, it's like, oh, I need 150 square meters of cladding. Here's 20 different cladding options. At 100 square meters, here's the carbon footprint. And so it's this great sort of way of seeing the difference between all of these materials, you know, all equalized for the same amount of coverage on your building. So if it's brick, it's this thick, and if it's metal, it's this thick, but it's all been, you know, equalized so that you're actually seeing the results for the amount of that material it would take to cover that much area on your building. And so it's this kind of like, it's a useful tool because it gets you this answer, but it's also this great educational tool because here's all the options and you can kind of see them from highest carbon footprint to lowest carbon footprint, you know, in one glance. And so it really helps people kind of go, oh, I didn't know if I changed from this to that, it would have that big a difference. But it kind of inspires that kind of substitution where, you know, you can really see that one simple choice makes a difference of like sometimes several tons of emissions for one little building.
Yeah. It sounds like it's almost kind of a shopping list, but instead of a price, there's, you know, the environmental price.
It's
because I've been a big advocate of foam glass underneath sort of slab earthen floors. And I've just found out exactly how much embodied energy that's got. And I'm like, oh no.
Well, it's interesting because there's the foam glass that's made into sheets that is really high. There's the foam glass sort of gravel is a fraction of the embodied carbon. And I don't know if it's what the difference in the processing is, but all four companies that make the gravel, it's way, 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 like it's the lowest carbon option, you know, in the calculator. But the foam glass sheets are sort of like a mid-range option. Not sure why that is, but it's consistent across all of the different products. So it seems to be a thing, but yeah, we just started using the sort of foam glass gravel and, really happy with that. And it's got a really low carbon footprint. So.
Yes. Oh, well, that's good to hear because yeah, I've pretty much exclusively used the gravel. And yeah, to me, it's a wonder material. You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Moisture can only travel in one direction. It's lightweight. It's easy to install. Yeah, it compacts nicely.
Yeah, it's nice when it replaces something else too. It's like, I used to have to put gravel then insulation. Now I just put one thing and it's doing both. I've actually saved a step. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, I can't wait for that calculator to come out. That really sounds like it's gonna be like an invaluable tool.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to talk a little bit about what you're writing at the moment? Is that a thing you can talk about?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'm getting towards the end of the manuscript for a book that I'm co-authoring with Bruce King. So he wrote a book a few years ago called The New Carbon Architecture, and I contributed a chapter to that. And we kind of decided to collaborate on it's not really an update of that book. It's sort of a rethinking it on even a larger scale. But it's called Build Beyond Zero. And it's you know, basically a book about what I was just talking about. Can we actually transform not just the hippie buildings of the world, but all the buildings of the world to be carbon storing? And what would it take to do that? And what are the technologies and the hurdles and the life cycle analysis issues and like all of those sorts? It's a deep dive into, you know, literally, can we turn the building industry from an emitter to a storer? And so it's fun. It's hopefully will be kind of inspirational and kind of lay out a bit of a path forward. You know, okay, if we want to do this, what needs to happen? Yeah, it's been good. It's been really great to get a chance to really to. I think about it all the time, but it, you know, the way you think changes when you have to really write it all down and plan it out and like, oh yeah, what does this look like? And how do all of these things relate and who needs to be talking to who and what, you know, how does, you know, we look at the regulatory side and the manufacturing side and the design side and like how do all these things potentially contribute to this?
Yeah. I wanted to say that you're making better buildings book is like my number one recommendation for everyone.
Oh, great. Hey, so here's something we could talk about then. We just put the whole Making Better Buildings book online on the New Endeavor website. It's all there. So it's now free and searchable and accessible, the whole thing. So we called it the Sustainable Materials Encyclopedia, and it's now nobody has to buy the book. They can just go use the website for free.
Oh, you've done yourself out of the royalties, but for the greater good.
Yeah, well, I won't be able to buy a bag of chips, you know, from the royalties anymore. So.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Oh my goodness. How good was that? Huge thanks to Chris for taking the time. We had to book in the episode recording months in advance. He is a busy man. So thank you, Chris, for making a hole in your schedule. As per usual, there is loads of links to the items discussed in the show notes. And I think for those listening on Spotify, those show notes sometimes don't work. So you might want to head to the Building Sustainability Podcast website. That is buildingsustainabilitypodcast.com. I just wanted to talk a little bit about one of the features I loved in Chris's home that we didn't get to speak about, and that is a wastewater heat recovery system. So when you're having a shower, all of your hot water goes down the drain and is wasted. So Chris's incoming water pipe is coiled around the shower outlet pipe. So all that hot water running down the drain then heats up the incoming water. So less energy is needed to bring the water tank up to the correct temperature. I think that detail shows you just how finely Chris is looking at the buildings and how we can make them more efficient. I'll stick a link to a video where Chris shows that system in the show notes. Okay, I also wanted to tell you that soon we'll be having an episode specifically on the Living Building Challenge that Chris touched on. So that is something to look out for. And also, I just want to end with two little tiny tips. Just how you can save the world in just a little micro way. And that is, one, buy the little sad, lonely bananas that are left on the shelf when everyone's ripped the bunches apart. Because they're the ones that are probably going to go in the bin. So you can save them from being food waste. And secondly, unsubscribe to all of those emails that you get. I've been doing this over the last few months. And not only does it feel great to know that you're reducing the amount of energy from the sort of server racks that are sending out all these millions of emails, but it also reduces digital clutter. And I think that can only just make you feel better. So there you go. Micro tips. I think that's it from me. Remember to subscribe and never miss an episode. Head to the Patreon site if you want to support. And if you don't have any money, the absolute best thing you could be doing is share this episode. Share it wide and far. And hopefully together we can save the world with buildings. Okay, stay safe everybody. Oh, and just for Tom Fell, nice.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.